So
same. Well done, huh? Are we missing anyone?
No.
Okay, so on this question of humanism, is it clear to people what a humanist is, according to this interpretation anyway? There are other interpretations, but we won't get into those so much. So a humanist is someone who really is extremely dedicated to not just reading the works of the ancients, as medieval authors did, right? But actually writing like them and trying to recreate the world of antiquity, which, as we know, well, for them at least, was the way of reproducing the grandeur of Rome in their own time. And so someone who was a humanist actually saw himself as trying to revive not just some of the ideas or some of the stylistic elements of antiquity, but reviving a whole culture. And you did that through language and through style, through grammar and eloquence. That is, learning to be a Do you remember this?
No.
It comes from your reading. Yeah. You had it at a certain point. You probably said, "What in the world is that?" in the margin. Vir bonus, good man. Peritus is expert, right? In. Dicendi comes from dicere, speaking. So a good man who is eloquent. Now, so there are two halves here, right? A vir bonus, a good man, eloquent. Eloquent, good man. Now, both of those elements for humanists are equally important. And not only are they equally important, but they are intimately related to one another. The assumption is that if you are a good man, you will be an eloquent person. Vice versa, if you are an eloquent person, that's proof that you're a good man. Because you can't be the one without the other. Go, ça va sans dire, is the first thing. It's obvious, right? That is, if you speak like Cicero, that means that you're actually thinking like Cicero, that you're imbued with the mores of Cicero, right? And of ancient Rome. And so there is this strong continuity between these two things. So this is why many people, when they're thinking, especially according to one particular tradition of interpreting humanism, which is that of both Jim Hankins and Paul Oscar Christopher, who was his teacher, actually link grammar, rhetoric, and poetry with another subject, which is that of ethics. History, the study of history, is also can be part of this curriculum as well. But ethics, and I would say philosophy more in general, but ethics in particular, that is, being a person of good, not just moral standards, but also good moral practice. Right? So those two things are together. Kit, you're looking.
Yes, I'm just wondering why did they want to recreate the ancient world? Was it a political thing or was it a moral thing?
Petrarch, you may remember from the 14th century, looked at his society and said, "We are really in a bad place." morally speaking, politically speaking, where is the greatness and grandeur of Rome? Italy is completely taken over by foreign powers, right? The Roman Empire, the north, by the Christians. So the civilization of Rome has decayed. Why has it decayed? And why is our society not the great one of the past? Because we've abandoned the values and the language and the, everything associated with the greatness of Rome. And so they're trying to... He's the one who actually, one of the most influential promoters of this idea that there's this gulf between the time of Rome and his own time. This is kind of the origin of the Dark Ages, right? There was this dark gulf in between, but now finally we have this new culture. I'm simplifying enormously, obviously. I can give you the more elaborate version if you like, but I think for our purposes it's important just to have to simplify to this. So this is why the eloquence and the morals are part of that revival of the Roman world. But, of course, and here's the little wrinkle that brings us back to Aristotelianism in this, actually... Cicero is not systematic in his philosophy. Again, right? He gets well. He does have a couple of treatises, important treatises also for moral philosophy. But they're not just Aristotelian. They have other currents within them that various humanists, especially Leonardo Bruni, doesn't agree with. And so he, who Bruni, who was born in 1370. Dies in 1444, has been by training a lawyer, but then he's born in Arezzo, goes to Florence, learns Greek under one of the Greek emigres, Manuel Chrysoloras, starts studying Plato, but then after studying Plato, discovers that Plato actually doesn't like rhetoric in his Republic, right? Actually, he turns to Aristotle as someone who is a safer guide and to philosophy. And that is why, in this part of the introduction, Bruni and Aristotle, page 259 and so on, you have this explanation about how humanists like Bruni, but not just Bruni, many others as well, actually use Aristotle as their guide towards into philosophy. And which part of philosophy do some of them, I say some of them, especially value? Some of them especially value the aspect of ethics, which, as we've seen, was also a part of the scholastic curriculum, right? This is something that doesn't get acknowledged by Hankins to any extent. And it's just really important, actually. So what happens is that moral philosophy, which is studied by the scholastics, which is also studied by the humanists, is an area of contention between the two. That is, for the scholastics, moral philosophy is a technical subject, just like any other branch of philosophy. Therefore, the translation of Robert Grosseteste in stilted Latin, which was word-for-word translation, is perfectly fine. But Bruni turns around and says, actually, Aristotle's Ethics, which is a textbook, it's fundamental for moral philosophy in the period, this textbook needs to be retranslated into a more fluent Latin. And so in 1416, 1417, Bruni translates the Nicomachean Ethics again, 10 books, it's not short, into a language of Cicero, and it's a rhetorical translation. It is meant to sound like Cicero. It is not a technically precise translation. In fact, he gets raked over the coals by several professional philosophers of the time because his language terminology is not as precise as the former one. But what it does is it has a larger appeal to people who are not necessarily trained in the usual way, right? So it becomes an area of contention because there are two different approaches. You know, we were talking about a more technical approach on the one hand, and in this case, a more rhetorical approach to philosophy. This is what Bruni very much values. And so some people would say that the humanists just come and actually are, more than anything, despise the fact that the scholastics treat questions in philosophy. Remember, we were giving the example before of a question. There are other questions that one could ask in the case of moral philosophy, right? For instance, fundamental question that opens the Nicomachean Ethics: what is happiness? Pretty important, big subject, right? It is not happiness in the sense that we interpret happiness today, by the way. Happiness is flourishing. It's not a feeling. It's doing well, flourishing as an individual. Or what is, how do you view the virtues? The moral virtues, on the one hand, and the intellectual virtues, on the other hand. Example, prudence. What is that? What is prudence? Is that a moral virtue? Is it an intellectual virtue? What does it enable you to do? Okay, those are questions that are fundamental to moral philosophy. And one interpretation of what the humanists do is that they turn their back on the fact that the scholastics ask those kinds of questions, and they are only interested in practical application of moral precepts. That is an interpretation with which I fundamentally disagree, by the way. But there are many who interpret humanists as trying to do that. That is, they think that they completely reject the view of the scholastics, and that the scholastics are only interested in theory. Actually, the scholastics aren't interested only in theory. They study moral philosophy, and every time they comment on the ethics, they say, why are we commenting on the ethics? We're commenting on the ethics because we want to live a moral life. Okay? But you cannot live a moral life without understanding the principles behind behind the virtues, and therefore we are going to talk, as Aristotle talks, about those principles. Obviously, they get applied during the course of the discussion. But this particular letter, the letter to Lauro Quirini that you have, 293, is really important because, among other things, it shows you some of the questions in ethics during this period. Lauro Quirini is a young upstart who has studied at the University of Padua. Apparently he wasn't listening very carefully in his philosophy lessons because Bruni really rakes him over the coals and takes him to task on the fact that he hasn't actually understood fundamental aspects of... And in fact, in Padua, they didn't have a regular teaching of moral philosophy in the university. Many Italian universities didn't until later on, or they certainly didn't tend to have specialists in moral philosophy in the university for a very long time, for very complex reasons that I don't need to explain. But here, what does he do? What are the issues that come out of this particular discussion, which you may or may not have enjoyed, I don't know. But do you remember what the, on page 293, what are these four issues to which he responds? Yeah, so happiness, okay, good. Felicitas, which is also daimonia in Greek, yeah.
Virtues.
Yeah, well, the second one is actually, yeah, that's right. Virtues, what about the virtues? Well, we'll get to them. Aristotle says they are means, you seek to prove the opposite. Third, you maintain that virtues arise from nature rather than habituation. And fourth, you inquire whether a man who has one virtue has all of them. How did you find this piece? Was it Interesting? Difficult?
Difficult, I think.
Okay, what are some of the aspects here that you came away with? Where does this question concentrate on particular questions of these? Hint, it does. Which ones? Which are the two main questions that the whole discussion revolves around?
Civil life and political life, isn't it?
Okay, so those are part of the first question. Yeah, so that the first question gets a lot of attention.
Yeah.
And then the other question that gets a lot of attention is that virtues as a mean.
Mm.
Right? The other 2 points, third and fourth, are treated very summarily towards the end. Okay. Yes, so let's talk about happiness and action and contemplation, first of all. Did you understand what this was about?
Well, some people pushed for the contemplative life being the right way.
That's
to
right.
Live, whereas others said the active life was the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an argument between the two sides.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Aristotle actually says that in life, we actually pursue happiness in various modes, right? But everyone's life includes aspects of action and aspects of contemplation. Just like we have moments, I hope, in which we retire to our bedroom and read Boethius or meditate. Sorry. Are you okay?
Sorry.
Good thing you're not drinking it. You might just throw it up. And other moments in which we might be doing our regular activities, right? But actually, action is more than just the daily grind, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does that go beyond that?
Is it living a good life? Doing, like Bruni, who's called civic humanism, made you a better citizen. So if you're active, you could become a better citizen and do good things.
Mm.
Whereas if you lived a contemplative life, you were dissociated from the world, really.
Who were the people who were living a contemplative life in Bruni's time?
The monks.
Monks, exactly. Especially the monks. And then you had, in addition, the friars who actually lived in cities and did preaching and other activities, so they were less contemplative. They were more in the urban context, right?
Mm-hmm.
But monks, yes, absolutely, apart from society, distant, spending a lot of time in prayer, although one of the orders, the Benedictines in particular, this is something drilled into us in Italy all the time. What is the motto of the Benedictines? Ora et labora, pray and work. Yeah, right. So your day gets divided, right? And the monasteries are self-sufficient. So that means that you have to go out and work the vegetable garden as well. Sorry.
They actually do both then?
They do both. Exactly, yes. Right. But there are other orders that increasingly just do a life of prayer, and they are known for their very severe, rigid moments during the day and or during the night of getting up and having times of prayer. And they might have a whole class of servants or, in fact, the, what are they called? Those who till the soil. Help me. What is this class called?
It sounds like
labourers, yeah.
It sounds very similar to what the original adult education model was all about, which is for people who, you know, industrialisation, when people were working in the factories and toiling on the land, that they had adult education to go to, which addressed the toil and that they could study the arts, philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. To have that,
excellent.
That balance.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. But here, I think what Bruni is trying to emphasize against some of those who in his time and previous times had argued that, for instance, marriage is not ideal, but well, we need it for the propagation of the species, so okay. Or we need it because this is the argument from St. Paul, right? If you can't contain yourselves, you can't...
It's better to get married.
Exactly. Better to get married than to burn with passion, right? So it's not necessarily the most enthusiastic endorsement of wedlock that you can find. So there is a sense in which monks especially exalted this view, right, of being a part in life of contemplation as superior to a life of involvement in society. But others in Bruni's time, especially thinking about Cicero, of all things, what did he embrace? The political life, right? Constant political life. And many, not all humanists, Petrarch actually thought that Cicero was completely wrong on this score. And maybe he was, because eventually he got his just desserts, right, when he was on the wrong side of the fence. But he thought, many humanists thought, that actually one should emphasize also the life of involvement in the civic community and the life of the political animal, as Aristotle talked about man in the politics, you know. So there is this tension in Aristotle himself, saying that there is an action, a life of action and a life of contemplation. The one is more divine, but the other one is more achievable. The one is going to be more something that you can actually gear yourself towards, and the other one, if you can get to it, is a boon. Right. But that's part of that question of happiness. Where do you actually find fulfillment or eudaimonia? You find it, you see here at the bottom of 293, I tell you that happiness is activity in accordance with perfect virtue in a perfect life. Now, notice, by activity, he doesn't mean that this has to be the active life. Because you're active, whether you are in the active life or whether you're contemplating, right? You're still active. But it is an activity in accordance with perfect virtue in a perfect life. And then it's just a question of how you express that. Whether you do that in the context of marriage or and being involved in your community, or as a scholar, maybe, who is retiring to his study and reading and writing books. So which aspect here did Querini not understand, and what aspect does Bruni rebuke him for? Yeah, that is a one of the arguments that Querini brings in. That is that surely it's not possible just to assume that contemplation is a good thing, because actually we never know something completely. So there is this defect within knowledge. You never have a full knowledge of things. Small indeed is the knowledge of man, and it lasts but a little while. But actually there's a sense in which he comes back and says, you know what, if you read his works very carefully, you'll find out that there's an irrational part of man, there's a rational part of man. Both of these are present, and both of these are things that you pursue, right? that make sense to people? There's a sense in which... No, Sandra.
Sorry.
Yes?
Say it again.
Okay, so, he says... at the top of 294. The proper activity of man and happiness are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. Your exposition is incorrect. The contemplative life is not the proper life of man, but the active life. In this particular context, Bruni changes his mind, by the way. In some other works, he emphasizes some other aspects. Mm-hmm. But in this one, he says, actually, the active life is the proper life of man. Even though, in fact, he goes on to say, a man does not contemplate qua man, or inasmuch as he is man, but rather inasmuch as he is something divine and separate. Justice, temperance, fortitude, and the other moral virtues he exercises as a man. The life, then, of moral virtue is properly the life of man. So this life that we don't, which we don't share with the animals, because this is part of our rational soul and not part of the sensitive soul or the vegetative soul. This is something that is actually characteristic of man as man. And therefore we can aim for that in practical life. We can aim for this kind of practical virtue. Yeah.
That feels very Scottish.
Does it?
Oh, very.
But what do you mean by virtue?
Well, virtue is very important. Yes, I would say it's, you know, it's quite, well, probably because of the Protestant.
Yes.
Religion in Scotland. That you know, temperance, virtue.
Yes.
All of those kind of things are always, you know, very, well, they were.
Doesn't happen in Glasgow much.
Well, they would be held up to be the you know, the ultimate.
Yeah.
How one would push to the goal.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's not Aristotle. Because that's Stoicism, to some extent, in which the object of human life is to pursue virtue. In which happiness, in fact, is virtue, achieving virtue. For Aristotle has what is called an inclusivist idea of happiness and the good, which is that there are all kinds of things that are components of happiness. You cannot be happy if you're virtuous and you're poor. Or at least the person who is virtuous and well off is going to be happier than the person who's virtuous and poor, right? And the person who is virtuous and happily married and well off and whose memory after he has died continues on in a positive way and people don't raise doubts about his financial dealings or whatever, will be more happy than the person for whom the opposite is the case, right? So this inclusivist idea is that actually all of these things together make up flourishing for Aristotle. And that's something that is quite different from that you've just described. So that's quite interesting to think about. How those are opposed to each other. Okay. By the way, ethics is now a big thing. It's becoming increasingly big. This is a book that I edited with a colleague of mine a few years back, Rethinking Virtue, Reforming Society, which has actually, despite, I didn't think it would, has become something that a lot of people read. Amazing. This is another one, Living Well in Renaissance Italy, The Virtues of Humanism and the Irony of Leon Battista Alberti, who someone mentioned Alberti before. So this is actually also fairly recent. And then Moral Philosophy on the Threshold of Modernity is yet another investigation into how, in this period, people started thinking a bit differently about about virtue and how it fit in with other topics. And here you have a section on scholastics and neo-scholastics, as well as humanists and theories of human rights and dominion, and reformers as well, who are all being surveyed in this. This is co-edited by, among others, Joe Cray, who is one of the most important students of moral philosophy in the period. She's at the Warburg Institute in London.
Reforming society.
So, yeah, just pass those around and write those down. What's interesting about this discussion between action and contemplation is that I've actually written an encyclopedia entry on this not so long ago, action and contemplation. And the more you read about it in the period, the more you see that actually the humanists are not universally more for action or more for contemplation. They have different views among them. And increasingly, actually, there is a sense that contemplation becomes the ideal for them. And that that sense of contemplation is something that merges with a sense of religious devotion, increasingly, especially in the 16th century. They even actually start talking about three types of life: the active life, the contemplative life, and the religious life. And some of them thinking that the religious life, that is the life of loving God in particular, is the most important of the three. So this idea that you may have of humanists as people who only look at the secular world, or who may even, you know, and this is confusing because we have modern humanists who are atheists, right? Mm-hmm. A completely different movement. We might have the idea that humanists are like that, but they're not. And Bruni, for instance, is actually deeply Christian, Catholic, obviously, and has a sense that even though he's not talking very much here about God, he does, at the bottom of 295, have this particular instance in which he says, a man can, in fact, have knowledge of an almost infinite number of things, provided he is willing to spend time studying them. He has surely a mind that partakes of the divine mind, right? It is a mind of that is separate from us, and he is, as it were, a mortal God. And here there's some influence of Platonic doctrines coming through, but also Christian ones. This is Augustine peeking through in many ways.
And how do they distinguish between the religious life and the contemplative life? What were the contemplatives doing?
The contemplative would be closeted reading books. Whereas the religious would actually be a life of prayer and devotion in that way, yeah. And that actually takes on a different hue with the rise of the Jesuits, for instance. You remember their meditative practices that they have, of thinking on the cross, for instance. And, yeah, so that actually takes it in a different direction. You can close the window if you want, if it's closer. People are cold. Okay. What is more important, do you think? The intellect or the will?
Important to getting things done.
What is more important within the economy of the human soul? These are topics that you discuss with your friends all the time, right? I'm interested to see what answers they come up with.
I'm not sure what they mean by will, actually, to be honest.
Can you have one without the other?
As a human being, you can't have one without the other. But the question is, which one of the two is stronger? Or as you make decisions, for instance, is it more on the basis of knowledge, or is it more on the, is will more important for your moral orientation? This is a You don't have to answer. That's fine. This is a big argument that develops in the period between Franciscans, for instance, who say the will is the most noble aspect of the human soul, and therefore we need to cultivate it by, for instance, by devotion, right? And on the other hand, the Dominicans, who believe that the intellect is more important, and that you manifest that by the study of theology, for instance, and preaching. So there's this tension within interpreters of this time. And what does Bruni tell his young upstart friend? Pages 2, bottom of 295, 296. Apparently, Lauro Querini had said the will is what is most common, right? And therefore it is more noble than the intellect. And Bruni turns around and says, that's absolute rubbish, right? Because if you're thinking that the faculty of the soul that is the most common is the most noble, then the vegetative faculty, vegetative soul, which we have in common with the lower animals, for instance, ought to be the most noble. But of course, that makes no sense whatsoever, because what distinguishes us is our power of reason, right? Well, my dog has a will, sometimes hard to drive direct, but I'm not sure that reason is going to actually keep her from barking when she's not supposed to be barking and waking us up at night. But presumably I can tell one of my children to turn their music down and they might actually listen eventually. Wishful thinking. Okay, so these are topics. It's interesting to see these at play here, because we have this idea that humanists are only interested in very practical questions of individual circumstance and what do you do in those circumstances, and well, your solution may be different from mine, and so forth and so on. But actually, here he is debating issues that are classic in scholastic philosophy of the period. Absolutely nothing really different from that. But, of course, it's a different mode. It's a different mode. It's a different mode of expression. This is a letter, after all. Mm-hmm. Right? And if you read the Latin, you'll find that the language is very polished, that it is something meant for circulation to a broad audience, that the terminology is not technical as you might expect it to be, but it's actually a much broader appeal. Okay, so that's the first problem. That's done. Then he goes to the second problem, which is question of whether virtue is a mean. And maybe here I need to explain things to you for a moment. Let's take courage. Courage can have, for Aristotle, two different aspects. You can have, that is, two different extremes. You can have the foolhardy, the person who goes out in front of the car, or my favorite examples are people who go around in the winter dressed in dark and expect to be seen. And then complain when they get run over. Anyway. And then on the other extreme, you have the very, very cautious, right? Kind. And so he says courage is somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. It's not the arithmetic middle on the line, but there is a sense in which true virtue is going to be in the middle between two different extremes, right? In that sense. Anger you can think of in the same way as a middle between calmness and being completely going off the handle. Obviously that's a vice. But if you're thinking about virtues, then you have something a lot more more tangible in terms of something that is that you can place on a spectrum. So justice is another example. You give to each his own. That's the definition of justice. And so that's between inequity and then going around and doing what Michel Foucault and others did in the 60s in Paris, that is distributing university degrees to everyone they met on the bus. Right? That was largesse. But it wasn't justice. So Aristotle would say that that's not a virtue because that's an extreme, right? Or there's that could be the same for magnanimity or any number of other virtues. Aristotle lists 12 moral virtues that are of that kind. So he says, you don't think that, well, you asserted that all virtues are means. Querini did. But actually, he says, there's a problem here because moral virtues are means, as you say, but actually, Aristotle, in addition to moral virtues, talks about intellectual virtues. Did you find the intellectual virtues in this passage? Sorry?
297.
Yeah, 297. Where do you find them?
Right. Oh, sorry.
At the top, yeah.
Prudence, temperance, justice.
So he says, you talk about prudence, temperance, and justice. All three, right? But actually, of those three, justice and temperance are moral virtues, and prudence is an intellectual virtue for Aristotle. He has a scale that goes from art or techne to prudence to knowledge all the way up to sophia, which is wisdom for Aristotle. These are 5 intellectual virtues. But at the same time, you've got 12 intellectual virtues. So he says you're completely mixed up because you say, oh, well, actually all the virtues are means, or you doubt that virtue is a mean, but actually these moral virtues are means. The intellectual virtues are not means. They do not find themselves, that is, in the middle between.
Does that mean they're absolute?
No. Philosophy at the time doesn't talk about absolutes, as far as I can recall. Any examples of absolutes? It's a different language. Sorry?
By the humanist.
Even in Scholastic. You can talk about the absolute good, but they don't really have this. We put absolutes against relatives. That's our discourse.
Absolutes against means.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they don't think in those terms so much. They also, because he's not thinking in a Platonic sense of these ideas, right? These justice with a capital J and so on. So for him, virtues are much more something that are part of everyday dealing in particular circumstances. So his whole description of virtues is actually very down to earth. He's talking about justice is giving to each one his due in particular circumstances. Example, or historical example, or example from poetry. In the Iliad, this happens. Or you know, justice is not just going out and giving all of your money indiscriminately to your employees. It's giving to each person his due in a particular circumstance. So it's less the language of absolutes the way we think of it, which I think comes out of the Enlightenment than that of Aristotle and Scholastic philosophy. It's just a term you don't tend to think to find so much. So this is what where he's there at the middle of the page, middle paragraph. A virtue is a kind of mean between excess and defect, true, but this is not to say that there is some mediocrity in the virtue itself. So the man who has temperance is not moderately temperate, but altogether temperate. So that's, he would say altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, maybe we could say maybe absolutely, but all, he says altogether, yeah. And he who possesses justice is not moderately just, but altogether just, yeah. And some justice, temperance is a kind of mean with respect to pleasures. So the temperate man is moderate with respect to the pleasures, not with respect to temperance. Okay, and then he goes on to explain the third and the fourth aspects. One is doubt. You seem to be in doubt whether, by the way, this is typical scholastic phrasing, I doubt whether this is the case, or I question whether this is the case, or whether the other case. Whether virtues are produced by nature or by practice. And here he recalls the whole Aristotelian theory by which virtue is developed by habit. I become generous by being generous. I become just by acting that out. And then in the very last section, he talks about whether there exists between the virtues themselves any sequence and connection such that the man who possesses one virtue necessarily possesses all the rest as well. This is called the theory of the interconnection of the virtues. In other words, if I am temperate, must I necessarily also be liberal? Or is it possible for Sandra, say, to be liberal but not temperate? Or not something else? And the answer Aristotle gives is that if you have one of these virtues that are developed by habit, you actually have all of them, because you are simultaneously working on all of them. For natural virtues, it's another matter altogether. But for those that are developed, then all of those develop at once, which means that if you stop being liberal or generous, you also at the same time stop being just and everything else, right? It's an interesting point of view. This is not original with Querini. It's not original with Bruni. These are common questions that you find in all the commentaries of the Ethics from the 13th century on. So they're exactly the same kinds of questions that the scholastics are worried about. But they're placed in a slightly different context, in a different kind of work, with a different kind of audience, right? So this is a brand of Aristotelianism, which is not necessarily distinct from the others because it's exploring altogether different questions, but because it looks at those questions from a different stylistic point of view. It happens a little bit more, increasingly more outside of a formal setting. You'll remember Bruni is not a university professor. He's not. He's just the chancellor of Florence. He's in the head of the diplomacy department, the department for writing letters to, you know, for ambassadors, and so forth. And so he's really, his specialty is not philosophy. His specialty is eloquence and convincing, persuading people through his great Latin style. Yeah. And that's really, I guess, one of the aspects of the way in which some humanists, at least, approach philosophy. Many humanists approach philosophy in the period is to increasingly try to broaden its spectrum of appeal. So outside of the universities, you can also do philosophy, but it will be a slightly more,
it's almost lived in philosophy.
A what, sorry?
Almost lived.
Practical?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Because it's also supposed to be lived for the others.
Yeah.
But it's a more eloquent and less technical philosophy. Okay, it's couched in a language that more people can understand. It's slightly less elitist. Slightly.
More accessible.
Yeah. Okay? But not altogether popular at all. Yeah. Because, keep in mind, these are all very highly skilled people. They probably make up 1% of the population at most. Probably less. They have Latin, good Latin. They have access to manuscripts. They're often rich. You know, they can afford an education of this kind. But humanists do try to make it something that is not just a part of the curriculum of a university or class or a theologically trained elite, but is more part of the common curriculum for other people. What they don't do in this particular time is take the further step of saying, well, if we're going to really promote this philosophy, why don't we do it in the vernacular? Because they think Latin is the language in which Cicero spoke. It is. It really has the structures and the vocabulary that the vernacular doesn't have, right? And we'll see, I think, next week in part, that in the 16th century things change radically. They get reoriented. You continue to have lots of works produced in philosophy in Latin, but increasingly also in the vernacular, carrying the process one step further. Mounting with a case of Descartes in 1637, whatever, where he writes in French, right, the fundamental work of early modern philosophy, which is called Le Discours de la Méthode, right, the discourses on the method, and it's written in French. And of course, doesn't mean that all philosophy after him is written in French. That's not true at all. But he is actually making a statement by writing in French. And that ground is being prepared by the people that Ana Laura is going to be talking about next time. Yeah.
So if the humanists are trying to take it out of the universities and spreading it wider, where are they spreading it wider? Into schools?
Yes.
Right.
So into schools, but also into private reading and circles.
Study,
so humanists are educators by profession very often.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so they establish schools in which this new curriculum that we were talking about gets implemented, and they increasingly convince the nobility and princes that they should send their, especially sons, sometimes daughters, to those schools, because they will then have a leg up in life and they'll be able to speak the best Latin and get ahead more swiftly than others and more effectively. And so the schools are an important place in which grammar and rhetoric are accompanied also by reading works that, such as Cicero's Tusculan Disputations, for instance, or other philosophical works that are Latin and written in good Latin. But that happens also increasingly at the university level as well. So they establish chairs of rhetoric, for instance, in the universities. Humanists end up teaching in the universities. Well, why not? It's a way of promoting their approach and their subject area, and you have people teaching those subjects. Even though they're rhetoricians, they eventually start teaching philosophical works as well. And you do have them in the 16th century, as well as in the 15th century, second half of the 15th century, rhetoricians teaching Aristotle's Ethics, for instance. That never happened before. You would always be a professor of philosophy to teach the ethics, but later on it also became possible as a professor of rhetoric to teach that same book, but from a different perspective. Then eventually they start dealing much more with the original Greek text, because there are many of the humanists are know Greek quite well, and start teaching their students also on the basis of those other Greek texts. But that's a very, very slow process that develops over time.
Isn't it also developed in the courts as well? It's taken on...
Yeah, exactly. So that depends. One of the chapters actually in that book, Rethinking Virtue, is about the contexts of ethics. So the schools, the courts, and the... what would we call them? The circles, the learned circles, yeah, in which they would get together and converse. As you might do if you have a book club, for instance, or something of that sort. And that's an open environment, although all male, of course, typically all male, in which the elite of society, those who are really well acquainted with these texts, would get together and discuss. Machiavelli was involved in one of these groups, very famous groups called the Orti Oricellari, after the name of the gardens where they met. But there were plenty of other groups in the 15th century as well, in Florence and elsewhere. There's a group that gets together on Marsilio Ficino to read Platonic works, for instance. And there are other groups all over Italy, actually, that get together. There's Giovanni Pontano in Naples, who has what's called an Accademia Pontaniana. So it's called an academy. It's actually is basically a reading group. It's a way of it's a discussion group, basically. But they call it an Accademia, yeah, and that gets adopted as a name because Plato and his disciples were. Their circle was called, their school was called the Academy, right? Remember, so that name gets taken, yeah? So you have those academies that are outside of the courts. You have in the courts themselves, you have people who, for instance, Henry III, I think, or is it Henry IV in France, mid-16th century, who actually goes out to the battlefield and... of course, he's not in the front line of battle. No king would be. But while he's in his tent and has moments of idleness, he actually has books that he reads, and he has people that he takes along with him to discuss those books with. And actually, when he is regularly in his palace after dinner, they have an hour of talking about philosophy. And so you have this evidence of people who are actually very interested in developing a bigger culture, because it's a bit like Elizabeth II, I suppose. Very often a sovereign doesn't get that kind of formal education that other people might, and so they want to develop it in their own way. She was a very successful Elizabeth II in getting tutorage, apparently, later on, but the others were. Right, I think we'll stop here and make things. You can go and party now for the rest of the evening. Anna Laura will talk about anti-Aristotelianism next time. There are readings outside the door that you collect. You can collect as usual. Don't take off with any of my books because I'll be very cross. And I have to sell them to Lisa. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Two readings, so make sure you take one from each pile.
Thank you.